Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson. Joining me a bit later today will be Tim Phillips, and we will tackle this week's review together, and I'll tell you about that in a second. I first have to initiate this week's show with, you know, all this sad news. As I'm recording this, it was announced a little while ago that Olivia de Havilland passed away. She was 104 years old, the last surviving of the four main stars of Gone with the Wind. I mean, she was in a ton of different things. You know, she was in Captain Blood and Suspicion, and, you know, she was working right up until, you know, the end of the 80s, just about, and then she's been quietly living a retirement in Paris ever since. But, you know, we've also had Regis Philbin pass away this weekend. Peter Green, one of the co-founders of Fleetwood Mac, he passed away. They say these things come in threes, so hopefully that is the end of the death notices for a while. But I'll talk more about Olivia de Havilland in a sec. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new horror sci-fi family drama, Color Out of Space, and it is now streaming on Netflix. And of course, I do have to finish off our Spielberg list. But, you know, to remark a little bit more about Olivia de Havilland, she was a really interesting woman in not just in the context of her being a very famous actor. Fun trivia, she was the last surviving of the four main actors in Gone with the Wind. And it's actually been that way since 1967. you know, she's been sort of the only one. She's politely declined all the anniversary offers to talk about the film on the anniversary. The last one was the 75th anniversary, which was just a few years ago in 2014. Well, I guess the 80th, but the last, like, sort of major commemoration was in 2014 when the 75th anniversary. She was the first female president of the jury at Cannes in 1965. She famously turned down the part of Blanche DuBois in A Streetcar Named Desire. Although she later clarified that it was because she had recently given birth and it had nothing to do with the material. Like, rumor has it she just did not want to do it, but she clarified later it's because she had just recently given birth. And she was also, there's a famous court decision called the de Havilland decision, which, you know, back in the golden days of Hollywood in the mid-40s, Jack Warner would add suspension periods to actors' contracts, meaning, you know, he could take them out of circulation whenever he wanted. And Olivia de Havilland led the eventual successful decision, court action, that stopped those kind of things and loosened studio control over talent. And it's called the de Havilland decision. So she was a great lady, a pioneer in more than one respect. And it's, you know, she lived 104 years, which was so remarkable. And she will be missed, for sure. Okay. I do have to get through the list pretty quickly, because we do have the review is a bit on the longer-ish side. So, as you know, the last few weeks we've been doing ranking all of Spielberg's movies, all 33 of them, from worst to best. 2 weeks ago we did the bottom 12, last week we did the middle 11, this week it's the top 10. So, number 10, I put Jurassic Park at number 10. Depends on your age, sort of where I think Jurassic Park falls in the panacea, because I think a lot of people came of age with Jurassic Park. A lot of people who are adults now, obviously, because it came out in 93, so almost 30 years ago. And I think there's also a period where people came of age during Jaws, which was almost 50 years ago now. So, depending on, I think, what stage you were in your development, you either ranked Jaws very highly in the Spielberg list, or you ranked Jurassic Park very highly. I put it at number 10, because if there's one thing all the Jurassic Park sequels have proved, is that it was a very small needle to thread. The eye of that needle, in terms of balancing the wonder of dinosaurs and the terror of dinosaurs, because, as we all know, and I've mentioned this before on the show, the Jurassic Park films have just basically become slasher films with dinosaurs. Especially that last one, Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. Numero 9 is Minority Report. It is a great action movie. It's got a lot of really great set pieces. I think the one in the film where Tom Cruise's policeman character is getting an eye transplant and the pre-crime cops come in and search this flop house where he gets the procedure done. Maybe one of the best Spielberg sequences ever, like just from the camera work to the pacing to the little triangle robot creatures that are searching the house to the John Williams score. It is so beautifully executed. It's a great detective story. It's got some cyberpunk in there. It's got some film noir in there. Everything right up until the end, I think, is dandy. And I think we've discussed before on the show that Spielberg can't really mount the ending all the time. Number 8 is Lincoln. Kind of unusual for a biopic, focusing on one very small section of Abraham Lincoln's life, perhaps the most important section, when you think about the 13th Amendment and ruling slavery illegal in the United States. Amazing, expansive cast, but I mean, it's ultimately nothing if you don't get Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln. An incredible performance, so grounded, especially so relatable too, especially when you consider the mythic status of Lincoln. His face is carved onto a mountain, for crying out loud. So to really bring that character down to earth, make him personable, make him human, it is a remarkable achievement. And to get Daniel Day-Lewis, directed by Steven Spielberg, with a script by Tony Kushner, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful sight. Number 7 is Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Looking back, kind of a strange follow-up to Jaws, because in a very different era now, I think, you know, if a movie like Jaws were to come out and Steven Spielberg were like, okay, I'm not doing Jaws 2, that would kind of be a big flashing warning sign about his own commitment, because, you know, it seems like now people deliver that big, huge hit, and they have to get right into the sequel. Not Spielberg, he went for something completely different. And you sort of see where his comfort levels are, the themes he really kind of wants to explore. You know, one can make the point, too, that, you know, there's some pretty cynical stuff in Jaws, and that's just not there in Close Encounters. It's a more optimistic take of people, of the universe. It's not a universe of monsters or, you know, scary things. It is a universe of opportunity and education. And, you know, I think that's always been Spielberg's sort of wheelhouse, is just optimism and forward-thinking and forward-looking and doing better. Even if he says that, you know, Roy Neary wouldn't leave his family behind to go out into space. I don't know. We'll leave that there. Speaking of aliens, number 6 is E.T. the Extraterrestrial. I wasn't a big fan of this movie when I was a kid. I saw it on VHS, like when it came out on VHS. And this was like back in the day. It came out in 1982, and I don't think it came out on VHS until 86, 87. 4 or 5 years between theatrical release and home video release. I don't think so. I mean, even just like 10 years later with Titanic came out in theaters December. I don't think it came out on home video until like August or September the next year. Yeah, think about that. It's really quite extraordinary. But yeah, you know, looking back at it as an adult, though, I think I get into E.T. more. I think it really gets that wonder of being a kid, the issues of being a kid, especially being on the kid, you know, watching your parents get divorced, that sort of learned helplessness. It is, it's easy to sort of see why Elliot would find escape in this weird-looking alien creature. And that's, like, I think one of the remarkable things about E.T. is that E.T. just himself looks bizarre. And that you managed... I guess it's a real lesson about, you know, looks aren't everything. Because it's a bizarre-looking creature that you do find comfort with, and you do see beauty in eventually. But yeah, I've come to appreciate E.T. more and more as I've gotten older. And now for something completely different, number 5, Schindler's List. It is a marathon to get through this movie. It's 3 hours and 15 minutes, but it is, it just really wrecks you by the end. It's such a remarkable journey. It goes, like, step by step through this, like, horrible historical event, the Holocaust, of course, but also, you know, seeing Oscar Schindler transform from someone who's, like, this just opportunistic, money-hungry person who's willing to profit off misery, but then to see him change and develop and come to terms with his own failings, and, you know, to see him in the end talk about, you know, look at his suit and look at his watch and say, well, this, you know, the money I spent on this could have been another life. And, you know, at the end, it's, you know, the Jewish people are his accountant, played by Ben Kingsley, who's, like, comforting him and saying, like, you know, you did a lot, and you know, that should be, it should be enough. It's not, obviously it was never going to be enough, but it you know, the number of people that Schindler saved was certainly more than a lot of people. It's an incredible story, and really beautifully told, heart-wrenching too, heartbreaking in a lot of respects. Similarly, Munich, number 4. I don't think there's ever been a Spielberg story so complex. I don't mean that as a insult, but he's not a complex guy, Spielberg, or at least his movies usually aren't. But to look at both sides of this, and to look at, you know, not just the need, in the hands of, like, a lesser filmmaker, this would be like a simple revenge story about, you know, the Israeli response to the Munich Olympics and the massacre there. It would have been just about getting revenge and making them pay, and that's not what Spielberg's interested at all. And he really makes you see both sides of it. Not both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian thing, but between both sides of, do you get revenge, do you not get revenge? There's a great line at the end where Eric Bana confronts his handler, played by Jeffrey Rush, and says, you know, well, what was the point of all this? Everyone we killed has been replaced by worse people. And Jeffrey Rush just says to him, well, I cut my toenails every week. You know, why would I do that? They just grow back. Really kind of simply puts that into context. It's a thinking man's spy movie, that's for sure. I love Munich. It's such an incredible journey. Number 3 is Saving Private Ryan. Easily, like, the best 25 minutes of combat footage ever put to film. Tom Hanks solidifies his life and his rep and his work as sort of Mr. America, Captain America, even. You know, great cast of up-and-comers, like Vin Diesel and Jeremy Davies. Matt Damon, of course, this came right off Good Will Hunting. Great film that really captures, like, the heart and soul of the type of people who went to war in World War II and everything they accomplished. And, I mean, the middle part kind of sags a bit, but you get the really visceral initial 25 minutes on the beaches of Normandy, and then the final battle as they protect the bridge at the end. And by that point, you've gotten to know everybody who was on the squad. and, you know, to go through that, and the parting words of the Tom Hanks character to the Matt Damon character, like, you know, earn this, and the question of, like, did he earn it? Like, just going back home and living as good a life as possible, do you earn it? No easy answers. Anyway. Number 2 is Raiders of the Lost Ark, and, like, number 2 and number 1, like, you can go back and forth between, I think, what is number 2 and what is number 1, but for today, Raiders of the Lost Ark is number 2. It really captures the spirit and the fun of those old serials that that Spielberg and Lucas were kind of basing the character on. It's also really interesting that, you know, you can see a a new original character, almost created out of whole cloth, and then making it as seminal as like any character that's ever made it to screen, and whether that's Robin Hood or James Bond, you know, you really don't hit that level very often, where something just you make up something and it becomes a part of the culture. It doesn't just come and go. So for it to really kind of sink in and stay there, and not just stand on its own, but also become hugely influential. You know, you wouldn't get the Uncharted video games with any Indiana Jones. You don't get Tomb Raider video games. You don't get the Mummy movies. You don't get Romancing the Stone. There was a whole series of influences from Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the mastery that Spielberg brought to that movie cannot be denied. Mastery is also key to the number one position, which is Jaws. There are movies that kind of are elevated by their own story. I think Jaws is one of those. Not only is it like a really great movie, and you can read, I mean, a lot of people have been talking about the mayor from Jaws in context of COVID-19. People who are just, you know, concerned about the bottom dollar and making money and, getting the beaches open, so to speak. There's a new resonance to it, and I would check out an episode of Film Spotting where they talk about Jaws. They dig into that a lot. But also, the mythology behind the making of Jaws is really something else. You know, when you think about Spielberg making his big feature, not his feature debut, but, you know, having so much writing on this, including like his own future, goes over budget, the freaking shark never works. The story itself is fascinating before you even get to the story of the movie, which is also fascinating. So I will leave that there and take a break. And we are going to come right back in a sec and talk about something completely different, which is Color Out of Space. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
Exactly what happened?
Well, there was a boom. It was a couple nights ago, a boom and a flash of light and a vibration, and we came out and we saw this large rock.
Horrible.
And
it was, had some hideous smoke. And, oh my God, couldn't somebody have given me a comb? Jesus!
I'm with Arkham resident Nathan Gardner, who claims that an unidentified flying object landed in his
UFO witness? You said UFO. I didn't say UFO. Oh, for fuck's sake. Teresa, can you get out of here, please?
Right, and
we had a top hydrologist here, not a geologist.
Yeah, I think the freaked out abductee look suits you pretty well.
Very good. So the meteorite, which happened to mysteriously disappear before the time my team and I got here. Mr. Gardner, were you sober at the time that this event happened?
I like a bit of bourbon. It comes out of Texas.
And that was a clip from Color Out of Space. It is the new film from Richard Stanley, and it stars Nicolas Cage, Julie Richardson, Madeline Arthur, Brendan Meyer, Julian Hilliard, Elliot Knight, and Tommy Chong. I am now being joined on the line by Tim Phillips of stage and screen fame. Tim, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing well. How about yourself, Adam?
Getting by. Nothing left to add.
it's like also the same old of the pandemic crisis.
Well, I suppose that's true, but when we have so many people who will not wear the masks out of misplaced skepticism of their reliability or of science in general or of politicians and things. I suppose seeing people wear the mask is, no matter the circumstance, it's heartening that we still have people who will take the advice of experts in our society.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see through the rising cases throughout the world when you don't take that advice, what happens? But people still don't get it. It's crazy.
Absolutely. And speaking of crazy, we're going to review Color Out of Space this week.
That's crazy.
It is crazy.
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale about, you know, with COVID, a lot of people are moving out to the country, you know, get away from the city. Color Out of Space, cautionary tale. But what can happen when you move out into the country?
I'm going to assume that was perhaps not the reason why you wanted to review this week. So why don't we begin things with what attracted you to Color Out of Space as opposed to any of the other offerings on Netflix that are available right now?
Yeah, I kind of just wanted something weird and wild, and with Nicolas Cage. I haven't seen Mandy, actually, and I want to see that, but I wanted to just see him just, it was more for that, and it looked like it has some really cool visuals, so that's why I chose it. Watching it, Nicolas Cage has a few of his crazy moments, but he's got it pretty, he's pretty restrained throughout the film, which is good, too. It's actually a good performance by him, but I did want to see something weird, strange, and hopefully with some Nicolas Cage temper tantrums thrown in there.
He can be hit and miss at times, and sometimes he sort of misreads the tone. Like a really good example is Drive Angry, where I feel like that should have been, like, full tilt, crazy Nicolas Cage, but he's, like, this... He's almost like the straight man, and even though, what's his name? Who plays the devil's accountant in it? I forget his name. William Fichtner. William Fichtner's technically supposed to be the straight man in that movie, but, he plays it a bit too straight, and, in this, though, he gets it right. There's a scene where he comes in and says, after, you know, strange things start happening on this farm in the middle of the forest, which I never really understood how it's a farm in the middle of the forest, but when the strange things start happening and he tries to start the car to sort of get him and his family out of the area, and he's trying to start it, and he has this temper tantrum of a sort in the car, and he starts screaming at it and cussing, and then he goes back in the house and perfectly calmly he tells his kids, "The car is not happening." Which is just such a perfect Nicolas Cage line.
Yeah. Yeah, and I found a couple times it's almost like insert in script, okay, Nicolas Cage goes crazy here. It makes sense in the film because all this crazy supernatural stuff's happening, and obviously as more and more of it happens and it affects his family, he's going to get more and more out there with his reactions. But there was one where he's just in the car and he just starts pounding the steering wheel and shouting profanities, and it's kind of like insert Nicolas Cage freak out here kind of thing. It was really good. It was hilarious, but it just felt, you know, I think people expect that now. It's, you know, it's part of his genre is, you know, you're gonna have a Nicolas Cage freak out, so let's insert it here. And it was good, but it's at the same time it's kind of like you were saying, he's very restrained. He's almost, yeah, being a bit of a straight man up until that point, and then all of a sudden he just freaks out, which you can understand through the character and what's happening, but it also feels like it's just like insert freak out here kind of thing.
Yeah, it's I think there is a level of expectation, and I think it depends on sort of how the director knows how to use it too. And I think I was reading a thing that said Richard Stanley, who directed the film, was one of the reasons why he wanted to work with Nick Cage on this because he was thinking about Nick Cage's performance in Vampire's Kiss, which is like one of his like kind of really early roles, which not Fast Times early, but you know, back in like the early 90s when he was really coming up in Hollywood, that he wanted to tap into that energy, which is there, fortunately, in the film.
Yeah, it's there, here and there. Yeah, I've seen Vampire's Kiss, and he's way over the top in that film. That's early in his career. And I think he's friends with Jim Carrey, and he's actually inspired by Jim Carrey. I saw a documentary on that film to just be way over the top in that film. So he was just playing to the back row, he said, and just crazy, which is kind of what I was wanting from this. But then it turned out to be, you know, it turned out to be a really good sort of supernatural horror film, which I enjoyed. But yeah, if you have any recommendations just for total Nicolas Cage freakouts, I think during the COVID crisis, I could use one or two of those. Just wall to wall craziness.
It's interesting you mentioned Jim Carrey too, because they were in Peggy Sue Got Married together. I'm looking at Nicolas Cage's filmography now. I thought they were in Earth Girls Are Easy together, but no, I'm thinking of Jeff Goldblum, who was in Earth Girls Are Easy. I'm looking at his filmography because he seems to have these two modes lately where he's, I would like to say he's doing it for the money, but I can't imagine there's much money in movies like Vengeance, A Love Story, or The Humanity Bureau, or Kill Chain. But then he also has this other mode where he's doing things like Looking Glass, Mom and Dad, Mandy, as you said. He's doing voice work like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, where he's playing the film noir version of Spider-Man, or Teen Titans Go to the Movies, where he's doing the voice of Superman, which is an in-joke because he was going to be in Tim Burton's Superman movie way back in the day. He's kind of keenly aware of his power or his place in the culture as kind of like maybe a cult figure, at least very much like a fading former Hollywood juggernaut who would command big salaries and get award nominations. And then at the same time, he will just like do things clearly because he needs to work. Like the Humanity Bureau. I'm going to click on Humanity Bureau. And okay, here's the first line from the synopsis. In the future, war, climate, and political agendas have robbed America of its resources. An agency called the Humanity Bureau ensures citizens are efficient. Inefficient citizens are deported to a city called New Eden. Noah Cross, which is the Nicolas Cage character, is an agent of the Humanity Bureau who manages the deportation of Chester Hill, a former governor of Colorado who now lives in misery. So that's how the Humanity Bureau starts, co-starring, it must be a Canadian production because Sarah Lind, Hugh Dillon, Lorne Cardinal, who people remember as the sheriff on Corner Gas. So that's Nicolas Cage's life the rest of the time. In the meantime, he does this like really cool stuff like Color Out of Space with people like Richard Stanley, who has his own sort of weird career in the business, between, he started like everyone else. Well, not like everyone else, but like a lot of people in the 80s. He started with music videos and commercials, and then he graduates to features, and he makes this really great cyberpunk movie, Hardware. And then he goes to make Island of Dr. Moreau, which is a famously disastrous production he was replaced on. And then later made like a documentary to kind of reclaim that. And then, years go by. And he makes Color Out of Space, which is based on a Lovecraft story, which is hard enough to adapt. Like, Lovecraft is not a very accessible author, and if you don't believe me, ask Guillermo del Toro, who tried to make Out of the Mouth of Madness for years. There's like a lot of pent-up frustration in Color Out of Space, like, not just from Nicolas Cage, who, you know, probably wants to try to hang on to some of that that status by doing something like kind of bizarro and kind of niche like Color Out of Space, but at the same time you have Richard Stanley, who's feels like he really has something to say, like he's really got something to prove, and I think that adds a lot of a lot of, let's say, kapauza to the movie. That it gives it a lot of cachet, I think, other than just being like a, you know, a silly Nicolas Cage movie about, you know, crazy aliens and body horror and things like that.
Yeah, and I did some research into Richard Stanley too and his upbringing. His mother is an anthropologist and he studied anthropology, and his mother was a big Lovecraft fan, and she would read the short stories to him as a kid. And actually, when she was dying from cancer, he was reading stories to her as well, Lovecraft. So it's definitely a heartfelt project for him, for Richard Stanley. And I think his next project I was reading is he's looking at doing a Lovecraft adaptation as well for his follow-up. So he's it's definitely something he feels deeply. I think he did a great job with the film. But you know, yeah, it goes a lot deeper than your average Nicolas Cage freak out or weird sci-fi. It's something he's quite interested in, and I think he's really interested in the themes of, you know, humanity can't, we're not in total control of what happens, you know, to the planet, and with the meteor coming down and all the supernatural activity, you know, his family getting Nicolas Cage's family getting destroyed by it. It's just something you can't control. And I think, like, in these times, too, it's kind of interesting, like, with the COVID-19 pandemic, there's so much we can't control. You know, we're all inside now because of certain events that took place, and now we're kind of in this situation. So it's interesting, because I was reading about Lovecraft, too. I've never read any Howard Phillips Lovecraft, even though he's got the same last name as me. Could be a cousin, but I've never read anything by him. But his view is humanity was an unimportant part of any uncaring cosmos that could be swept away at any moment. So, you know, when you look at the film through those eyes, you know, we're not in control of what happens. Then it does add some gravitas to the whole project. But that's research I did. After, while watching it, I was like, this is a kind of a cool supernatural story, you know, and it's about this family who are struggling to cope through all these crazy events that keep happening. You know, like the mother and son getting fused together, and yeah, just, you know, they have the alpacas that are just being attacked by the supernatural forces. And then you've got Tommy Chong in there as this guy who seems to know, like a conspiracy theorist, but he knows what's happening, or he seems to have some insight into what's happening with the supernatural forces. So it's kind of interesting. Yeah. When you look at it from that perspective, it seems to go a lot deeper than maybe at first blush. And if I'm looking for just a straight Nicolas Cage freakout movie, Maybe I need to go to Drive Angry or something like that. Because this film, I think, yeah, there was much more of an intention to make something that, you know, powerful, that says something about humanity and our place in the universe. And the visuals are just outstanding, I would say. That was one of the things watching it without doing this research I did afterwards. The visuals are just stunning in this film, so... Kudos.
The visuals.
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to agree with you. The visuals are really, really great. A lot of practical effects too, which is like even the monster. You were talking about the merger between the mother and the youngest son. They're hit by like the blast of the color. and they end up merged and they become like this sort of creature that was very much like something out of The Thing, the Carpenter, The Thing, and there's so much of that in the film. There's so much of, you know, how the color affects different people differently, and there's, you know, body, you know, not modification, but, you know, sort of abuse of the body and you know, people carving symbols into them. And, you know, one character gets a rash that, looks like the worst case of dry skin you've ever seen, and it's also real and also visceral, and but in the background too is the fact that the color that comes from this meteorite that lands again on this farm in the middle of the forest. So I mean, automatically there's a bit of, you know, it's also weird, right? Like, I don't know how much of this is in the original Lovecraft story and how much of this comes from Richard Stanley, but you know, it's a farmhouse in the middle of the forest. They're raising alpacas and growing tomatoes. I don't know how that works, but it's a thing that happens. And yeah, so everything is already off in this weird sort of idyllic forest setting, and you don't even know at first if there's like a rest of the world or if this is like sort of like the Quiet Place, where stuff's already gone down and the world's already over, and maybe these are people living on their own in the middle of woods, unsure of the rest of the world. I mean, at the beginning you do meet this one character, Ward, who is a hydrologist and is trying to do tests on the local water safety. But I mean, other than that, you know, you could be mistaken for thinking that, you know, this is a post-apocalyptic society, and here this family is just living outside the collapse of civilization too. I almost wish it was that, because later you have people coming by the farm, the mayor and the sheriff and things, that makes you realize there is a civilization in existence already. But yeah, there's something very prescient about it, as you said. You know, when you see the mother Teresa, you know, Skyping with clients in her little attic office, which is so on point now. And the internet keeps going out because, yeah, they're in the boonies or wherever. And, you know, they're off the grid and they're, you know, raising their own stuff, and they're concerned about outsiders coming in. And it's so weird that that this film, which I think was made either in 2018 or 2019. I think it was that it did the film festival rounds last fall. So it's been in the pipe for a while, but it's interesting that, it's another one of those interesting things where we see these movies coming out now that we're able to draw such strong parallels to things that are happening to us right now, even though, these movies were made way in advance of COVID-19.
Yeah, it kind of, like I was joking earlier, it's sort of this cautionary tale about, you know, because a lot of people are moving, you know, away from cities now, given the pandemic, or trying to find property in the country, or going to a cottage, or what have you. And yeah, like this is kind of a weird setup where it's a forest and a farm at the same time. And the wife, she keeps losing clients because the internet keeps going out. But then that whole electronic interference has to do with the meteorite and everything that's happening with that. And it's pretty interesting. And I think early on they're saying they did move because wife Teresa, she had a mastectomy, and then they decided to move to his father's farmhouse, Nathan Gardner's father's farmhouse. So that's why they ended up out there. And then, yeah, but it is strange because there's like, it's almost like there's like this normalcy that there's a mayor and a sheriff, and you've got this young hydrologist who I don't usually interact with too many hydrologists, but like somebody who's there, you know, studying the water and because of some contamination. And you know, it's got all these sort of like normalcy to it, but then at the same time, it's just out there. And you know that from the get-go, like when Tommy Chong's character's introduced and he's studying the skies and what's happening. And you know, Nathan Gardner, played by Nicolas Cage, who you just know is going to, you know, he's going to start losing it eventually. He's going to start having some crazy outbursts. So yeah, it's never totally normal, but maybe the intention was to have it be somewhat normal, but like you said, it really isn't, because it's like a forest, a farmhouse in a forest, and these characters who are really eccentric, and it's an eccentric piece for sure. And I'm just looking at a picture here of Nicolas Cage when he went to Kazakhstan for that film festival. Do you remember that, when he was wearing the he's wearing quite the getup there, and everyone's like, why is he going to this film festival? And he's just like, just needed the money, I think.
Yeah, he's very famously sort of one of the victims of, or I guess victims is the right word, of, you know, the economic crash of 2008. He had a lot of, and I mean, he's also a famous spendthrift. Like, he spent thousands of dollars on, you know, comic books and things, and had to sell it in order to cover some of his losses. It's kind of a sad story in a way, but I mean, out of that, you get some of these kind of weird offerings, like Color Out in Space, or Mom and Dad, or you know, Mandy. He'll pop up on weird things for sure. And one of the things I do like is that, who plays the wife again? It's one of the Richardson sisters, Shirley Richardson. Yeah, and I mean, so other than her, it's mostly an unknown cast, and I don't think, well, Tommy Chong too, but Nicolas Cage is sort of like the star, and when, you know, it strikes me as it kind of reaches back to like the old Hammer horror movies, where you kind of build a film around like one of their big stars, like Peter Cushing or Christopher Lee, or Vincent Price was in a couple of them, where you get the star and you sort of build a thing around. I mean, granted, it's also an H.P. Lovecraft film, and you can, or an H.P. Lovecraft story, and you can make the argument that the H.P. Lovecraft is, in some circles, probably as big a celebrity as Nick Cage. But at the same time, you know, it's very much built around him, and part of it, watching this, is in the back of your mind, is like, well, when is Nick Cage gonna lose it? And I can't wait to watch him lose it. And and at the same time, there is that, where it does feel like very much like this is a family out of its depth a bit. And I think that's also the advantage of watching Nicolas Cage play quote unquote normal, because normal does feel out of his depth. And so it's the whole thing with the alpaca farm and all that. It is very much that here are a bunch of people out in the woods who probably shouldn't be out in the woods on their own, but you know, here we are. Here's this thing, and that speaks, of course, to the Lovecraft of this too, because I'm not sure the family would be. It's a Lovecraft short story, and Lovecraft doesn't kind of really care about families and things. He's more interested in the sciencey characters and the hubris of scientists and that kind of thing. So it deviates from that a bit, to the point where I think the hydrologist character Ward, he ends up kind of being the final person, and it's kind of a bit out of place, because we spend almost no time in the movie with Ward. We spend almost all of the time in the movie with the family. So it's a bit weird that when we get to the end game in the film, it's a character we haven't gotten to know too well, that has to go through the process of surviving whatever changes are going on in this land. I forget where I was going with this, but yeah, okay, Lovecraft. Lovecraft is very, as you said, he's very much of the idea that it's not just that he's, I guess, anti-human superiority, but he's downright, like, skeptical of it. He's downright like, no, not only are we humans defenseless in the face of the unknown, of what's out there, but it will completely obliterate us. And so it makes it for a very interesting statement, again, given the times, that a kind of, you know, there's learned helplessness, but in this instance, You are literally helpless. Anything you can do to get out of this will fail. There is no way to get out of this. And surviving it is almost completely incidental. It's almost completely accidental when the one character at the end manages to pull themselves out of the rubble of all this. It's almost nihilistic in a way. And I think that's why it's so hard for a lot of people to get into Lovecraft, and why it's kind of so hard to get these projects going too, which is another reason why I think it was interesting that they make the family the main characters, because one of the things I was thinking in the back of my head in this was Annihilation. Annihilation is probably the best Lovecraft movie Lovecraft never wrote. There's a kind of 80s dressing to all of this too. There's some Spielberg influence. There's some Stephen King influence too.
I noticed the poltergeist, like when the TV was going out and the young child, Jack, their youngest, is there. And yeah, it was very right. sort of like very much like Spielberg, and the dogs reacting to what's happening. And yeah, that's something you would get from an 80s, sort of early 90s, sort of almost like family horror movie. You get pieces of that as well.
Yeah, so I find it interesting that Richard Stanley has sort of found, at least with this story, he managed to find a way to sort of commercialize Lovecraft in an unexpected way. And so that, you know, all the themes and sort of ideas that make Lovecraft are there, but at the same time it's still kind of commercial. And it's interesting. And he's an obviously talented guy, and it seems like a shame to me that he hasn't really got a chance to exercise that more. Of course, if he was like kind of making movies on a regular basis, I wonder if we would even have gotten The Color Out of Space, because again, there is kind of a hunger to this that you know a director that probably gets more work probably wouldn't have managed to dig into this quite so enthusiastically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you were saying, mm-hmm. it's the family. It strikes me. I really like the film, but at the same time, the family isn't really, even though they are the central part of the film, like they're not really the main idea behind the film. And you do get that, like you're mentioning with Ward Phillips, the hydrologist, when he first appears, it's like he's almost like flirting with the daughter Lavinia, and you think, okay, is there going to be something here or something where we get to know this hydrologist better? And then he just kind of like takes water samples and says, don't drink the water. And then he's back at the end as like the, you know, one of the last people standing, say, don't drink the water kind of thing again. So it's, that's where I think, like, yeah, the bigger idea of, okay, we can't control what's going to happen in the universe here. It's just, you know, we can fall prey to this crazy meteorite supernatural activity that's going to, like, wipe out our alpacas and most of our family and everything like that. It seems to be the bigger thing. And it's almost like the characters, although I think they all do a good job. And the daughter, Lavinia, played by Madeline Arthur, I think she does a very good job in the film. She's a real focal point in it. Yeah, you've got the family's part of it, but at the same time, they're almost like chess pieces in a way for what's really happening, the overarching theme of the film, the sort of Lovecraftian theme of the whole thing. So it's, yeah, it's like I did like the characters and everything, but it's like they're, yeah, it's like they're being put through their paces in this larger, grander scheme of what's happening to the universe.
Yeah, I do think the film kind of falls apart in the third act. Not falls apart necessarily, but it seems like it starts really sprinting to get to an end point. It's kind of used up all its fuel, and it's not entirely sure how to wrap things up. Like, by bringing sort of Ward again, this very peripheral character, by bringing him back in and sort of making him the main sort of focal point as things get, you know, progressively worse and worse and worse on this land. I think that there's that. You also kind of, Ward also kind of has this vision of the world where the meteorite comes from, which is a kind of, I guess, an Easter egg for all the Lovecraft fans, because it's clearly the world of the Cthulhus and, you know, all these tentacle octopus space monsters and things. The great old ones, that's what they're called. So, you know, that's kind of getting... The movie hemorrhages on, like, shoving its own head up its rear end at that point. But, I mean, you're so close to the end, you kind of just go with it, too. But I think that there are two-thirds to three-quarters of a movie here that are really, really solid and show a lot of creativity and a lot of vision. And you know, really understand adaptation. Not necessarily like, I'm going to film this book and put it on screen, as, you know, there have been so many books that have been like that, where people just kind of, you know, rip pages from the book and there's your script. And, you know, it's a real true adaptation where Lovecraft fans will get into it, but it's also going to be accessible to an audience that may not necessarily be a Lovecraft fan. And, you know, that's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like, I'm not a Lovecraft fan. I haven't read any of his stuff, but what I sense is in a film like this, yeah, if this was the short story, I could see, you know, a lot in the writing, a lot of, you know, descriptions and stuff, and interior, maybe some interior thoughts of characters or something, which when you're doing a film, you really can't do that unless you do voiceover or something. So in this, I thought it was really good at establishing an atmosphere, you know, atmosphere of dread, impending dread, and also the visuals were spot on. And yeah, and the acting was very good as well. But, you know, yeah, the bigger purpose is sort of, you know, this is happening to the universe, right? I think of like a film like 2001, where the characters, they all do a fine job. Hal's probably the best, most compelling character in the whole thing.
Hal has an arc.
Yeah, but they're all, you know, part of this, you know, it's beyond their control. It's like what's happening in the whole universe, which is cool for this. And I'm looking forward to his next film, which is going to be another adaptation of Lovecraft, to see what he does with that as well, Richard Stanley.
Yeah, and I think if people want to explore further, I think the documentary he made about him trying to make Island of Dr. Moreau, I think that's on Netflix. I think it's called Lost Souls. And that's definitely worth checking out, especially if you're like me and you like sort of the behind the music, so to speak, stories about how movies get made. That's worth checking out too.
Awesome. That's on Netflix?
I'm pretty sure it's on Netflix. It's on one of the streamers at least. So it's called Lost Souls, so it's worth seeing.
Nice.
Yeah. All right, Tim. People want to recommend great Nick Cage performances, or how you can get into Lovecraftian horror. How can they find you on the internet?
Oh, if you have some Nick Cage movies you think I should check out, or Lovecraft stories I should read, you can email flashinthedeadpan@gmail.com, or find Flash in the Deadpan on social media. And I want to give a congrats to you, Adam, for the lifetime membership at EdVideo.
Oh, thank you.
So congrats on that.
I never have to pay membership dues again.
It's a practical award.
It is a practical award. Thank you. I do appreciate that. It was an unexpected honor, and I'm happy to carry it, because so much of my life has been entwined with EdVideo. It's nice to have that badge for sure. Thank you. And that is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you'd like to listen to it again, by all means, you can find us at our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics and Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can check out my News and Politics site, guelphpolitico.ca, or you can check out me writing about horror movies at nofspodcast.com. That's Nightmare on Film Street, nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.